We now know that Pius XII's actions in Italy and via diplomats throughout Eastern Europe could have saved as many as 850,000 Jewish lives. But don't hold your breath for Hollywood to make Pius's list anytime soon. It may be no friend to fascism, but the church has often been a willing vessel for communism, to the point of near convergence. To the surprise of some non-Catholics, the church has always been, in fact, something of a left-leaning institution. We did, after all, invent the concept of social justice, and there's a long history of infiltration of the churches by communist sympathizers and by activists and spies. In many cases, this occurs with the cooperation of priests. Sometimes they're the same people. In the 1930s, communists in the West were told to rejoin churches and other Western institutions to begin weakening them from the inside. The Communist Party's infiltration into Catholic seminaries was designed to turn the church from a spiritual hierarchy to a more explicitly political organization, with the goal of weaponizing it, encouraging the religious poor across the world to rebel against what the communists called the institutionalized violence of poverty. In 1968, as the clerical abuse crisis reached its zenith, the KGB-created Christian Peace Conference persuaded leftist South American bishops to hold a conference in Colombia to explore Marxist liberation ideology. Capitalism is the most effective engine of social mobility the human species has yet devised. But communists not only sought to leverage the church against it in the name of alleviating poverty, they also aimed to enfeeble the most powerful institutions of liberal Western capitalist democracies, like universities and the press, and they did a pretty good job in those cases. There's no higher calling to a Leninist than weakening the system upon which Western civilization is based, and that's Christianity, especially Christianity in its most potent Roman form. The Catholic Church was therefore identified by communists as more important to the success of the West even than the means of production. Saul Alinsky, author of the activist handbook Rules for Radicals, identified two basic social forces which, he said, might serve as the cornerstone of any effective community organization in 1980s Chicago. They were, first, the Catholic Church, and second, organized labor. The pro-abortion and pro-birth control Alinsky had lifelong friendships and working relationships with many Catholic priests, especially in Chicago, some of whom raised large sums of money for a project that came to be known as the Catholic Campaign for Human Development. That Catholic on Catholic Campaign for Human Development was added later in typically Orwellian, Marxist, Kafkaesque fashion because the CHD was getting a reputation for funding causes that weren't very Catholic, and in fact that ran directly contrary to church teachings. And Alinsky proudly explains his bamboozlement of the Catholic hierarchy in Rules for Radicals. Alinsky's CCHD is still active today, still endorsed by the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, and still collects money from ordinary Catholics, which it funnels into pro-abortion and pro-contraception groups under the guise of anti-poverty and racial healing. This is thanks to a combination of complicity and naivety from church leaders. To this day, hundreds of ordained ministers support outright Marxist organizations in America, and there are deep ties between church officials and far-left political activist groups, such as the Democratic Socialists of America. The Syracuse Cooperative Federal Credit Union receives funding from the CCHD, despite supporting gay marriage and donating to Planned Parenthood. In her last book, conservative hero Phyllis Schlafly reprinted documents that showed Barack Obama receiving his community organizer training in 1986 at Alinsky's Industrial Areas Foundation. And that was courtesy of the Catholic Archdiocese of Chicago. The Catholic Church's close association with communists goes all the way to the top. In September 2018, Francis signed a deal with the Chinese government that codified Communist Party interference in the selection of Chinese bishops. The deal not only grants the Chinese power to nominate bishops, but it also requires the Vatican to recognize 7 excommunicated bishops currently operating without papal consent in China. This deal makes China the only country in the world in which the Pope's authority to select bishops is circumscribed by state authority. And China isn't even a Catholic country. Persecution of Catholics in China is at its highest level since the Cultural Revolution, according to human rights campaigners. A longtime missionary and China expert, Father Sergio Ticozzi, told journalists the same month that Francis signed that deal that the Chinese government seeks absolute control over the Catholic Church. This agreement brings them closer to it, and with legitimacy derived from the Holy See itself. Matthew Schmitz from First Things suggests that the deal even violates commitments made at Vatican II, that the church should support neutral religious liberties rather than seek privileges from the state. In other words, Francis won't jeopardize his progressive activism to protect children from being raped, but he will suspend those principles along with centuries of church tradition to make deals with murderous totalitarian communists. Since at least as far back as Gregory VII, whose conflicts with Henry IV over the church's authority were largely settled in Rome's favor, the Vatican has insisted on no state interference in church matters. Until now. As a communist dictatorship, China is officially atheist, and it tolerates some religions while viciously persecuting others. There are about 12 million Chinese Catholics, but their worship is severely restricted. The government regularly tears down crosses, burns Bibles, and puts believers in concentration camps where they are gently reminded, on pain of death, to be loyal to communism before they are loyal to God. As many as 90,000 people may be detained in these re-education centers. And in August 2018, a Catholic news agency said Chinese police had broken up two summer camps for children. These children were aged 8 to 10, accusing the organizers of holding an illegal Christian event. In March 2018, the government used a crane to rip the last cross from the roof of an iconic Catholic church in the Henan province. And this is the regime to which Francis has handed control of bishop selection. Francis didn't do it alone. The cardinal at the heart of this deal between the Chinese government and Pope Francis, who traveled regularly to Beijing on the Pope's behalf over the past two decades until he was unfortunately indisposed recently, was also critical to the process. His name was Theodore McCarrick. And by 2005, McCarrick had been to China seven times on church business. According to Archbishop Vigano, one of Francis's first acts as Pope, just 3 months into his pontificate, had been to return McCarrick to active duty by dispatching him to the People's Republic. After re-ingratiating himself with the Chinese regime, and of course being billeted by the Chinese in seminaries, McCarrick dismissed warnings from Chinese bishops about state interference in worship. In February 2018, in an interview with Asia Times, Pope Francis made no mention of religious freedom in China, preferring instead to lavish praise on the Chinese government, telling the world not to fear the rise of China. Gregory VII is looking down on all this, and honestly, he's just thrilled. Chapter 3, Enemy of the People. Instances of child abuse in the Catholic Church have been dropping precipitously for decades, at least in the United States. And I won't be so rash as to claim that it doesn't happen anymore, but statistically speaking, the problem of child sex abuse in the Church appears to be correcting itself, or at least rapidly falling into line with other similar organizations. From a peak between 1965 and 1980, so one question you might be asking is, why are we still hearing about this? More specifically, why are we only hearing about it now? The main reason abuse claims and reporting about abuse claims trails the offences themselves by decades is that victims often take decades to speak out about their experiences. Quite often they pipe up in their mid-30s, and that was certainly the case for me. Although I can't speak for other victims, I have a pretty good idea why that might be, why it is that people don't tell their stories until much later in life. I don't think it's because anyone who ever got fiddled with has been so utterly traumatized by it he's been unable to function as a human being ever since. Now, doubtless for some victims that's the case, and of course my heart goes out to them, but I think people like that are in the minority. What I think's really going on is that by 30 you have enough else going on in your life. So disclosing the embarrassing fact that a priest years ago did something inappropriate to you isn't going to define you. It's not going to take over your entire existence. By the age of 35, you hopefully have a family of your own through whom your identity is forged and who can provide emotional support. The unfortunate minority who are permanently crippled by their child abuse experiences have understandably, I suppose, permitted it to define them so much that their entire being has become a sort of expression of the trauma. Now, I've known rape victims of both kinds, and I think the same thing is going on with them. Another explanation for the delay we've experienced in hearing about abuse that peaked in the 60s, 70s and 80s is the reliably useless finger-in-the-air approach from the church hierarchy, which, under Francis, has ascended to the status of a systematic cover-up. at the very highest levels, at the expense of victims past and present, in service to the continued power of a small group of cardinals and bishops, including the Pope himself. But it's not just that there are powerful homosexuals covering for each other. The structure and operations of the Vatican are riddled with bureaucracy and corruption that prevent vital reform. Just like any other city in which power and money are concentrated, the Vatican is rife with plots, backstabbing, and rivalry. But the usual skullduggery and jostling for position that go on in, say, Washington DC are elevated to theatrical levels of intrigue in the Vatican because the stakes are so high. After all, he who controls the Vatican controls the Catholic Church and thus commands spiritual authority of 1.2 billion people. And there's an awful lot of money sloshing around too, in relatively few hands. Most people familiar with the workings of the Vatican describe it as comically ineffective and dysfunctional, the product of a thousand little schemes that make critical documents disappear at just the right moment, and which make accountability practically impossible. Add to that the Vatican's way of dealing with sensitive matters, which often leaves no paper trail, and you have a recipe for chaos, easily exploitable by well-connected sociopaths who can command the loyalty of the Curia, whether through ideological fealty or straight intimidation. Kurt Martens, a professor of canon law at the Catholic University of America, has explained it like this. Rome often works with oral reports, he says, and that makes it harder. Quote, it's the Italian way of dealing with these things, especially when they involve a cardinal or a bishop. End quote. This may be one reason Vigano's allegations prove difficult to substantiate or to disprove. There simply aren't records of bishops who've been scolded. Corruption and misappropriation of funds are standard operating procedure in Rome. In September 2018, the Vatican confirmed that the Sistine Chapel Choir's manager and director were being investigated for money laundering, fraud, and embezzlement. Profits from concerts are said to have been paid directly into an account held by manager Michelangelo Nardella and director Monsignor Massimo Palombola and used for personal expenses. Palombola is also under investigation for abusive conduct during choir rehearsals. By Vatican standards, though, that's JV-level stuff. And to give you an example of what I mean, consider the Vatican Bank. The Vatican Bank is one of the most disreputable and ineptly managed financial institutions in the world. For decades, it has operated as a tax haven for wealthy Italians and a money launderer's paradise. It is essentially an offshore bank in the middle of Rome, subject to its own laws. And it was, therefore, at least for a while, incredibly resistant to demands for information from the Italian authorities, who are not themselves always the perfect model of good governance. International media scrutiny of the bank is said to be one of the reasons Benedict XVI resigned, admitting privately to friends that he was unable to tackle the entrenched special interests in Rome. After taking some time to admire Pope Francis for wearing a plastic watch and dining in the Vatican canteen, The Guardian's Paul Vallely gave a decent account recently of how Cardinal George Pell, appointed by Francis, began a review of the bank's operations. Pell had successfully overhauled the church's finances in Sydney and Melbourne. The Australian son of a former heavyweight boxer, Pell is a political and doctrinal conservative who speaks aggressively and does not believe in man-made climate change. He's a cult hero among conservative Catholics, so you can just imagine what the Lavender Mafia think of him. Vallely notes grudgingly that, for all his conservatism, Pell had for years been a vocal critic of the Roman Catholic bureaucracy and its corruption. Pell moved quickly after he was appointed, and he made a lot of enemies. He's a straight dealer to the point of unbearable bluntness, especially in the delicately perfumed and gold-embroidered world of the Holy See. So Pell probably didn't anticipate getting tripped up by dirty tactics. In this case, stories leaked to the press about, yep, clerical abuse. The press reports were coincidentally timed, arriving just as Pell's reforms of the bank were beginning to take hold. It was alleged in the media that Pell was soft on child abuse, thanks to offhand comments he'd made years before in his typically ribald and direct Australian fashion. It was suggested that he may even himself have some questions to answer about covering up abuse. Then the allegations widened as he began to demand more of bank officials and uncover more bureaucracy and more corruption. Stories appeared that directly accused him of historic sex abuse, at which point he had to stop reforming the bank, put his work on hold, and return to Australia to try to clear his name. That's what he did, and now, of course, Vatican Bank reforms are stalling, just as those intriguers intended. And this is how efforts to clean up the Roman Catholic Church usually end. Another factor to consider in the delay between these abuses and us hearing about them now is how incompetently the media cover religion. For a subject as critical not just to world affairs, but to Western civilization itself, religion is almost unimaginably poorly served by establishment reporters. Very few British or American newspapers have dedicated religion correspondents any longer, and where religion is covered nationally in the United States, it's almost always subservient to the political agenda of the masthead, with reporting from people who know hilariously little about their subject. With a few exceptions, publications aimed at millennials are astonishingly bad at reporting on religious subjects, and that might be because there are literally no Christians on staff. There are some exceptions. Although she makes no effort to hide her leftism, Vox's Tara Isabella Burton at least makes an effort to understand the views of her subjects and is properly qualified. She seems to know her beat. But her stablemates at Vox merrily hold forth on religion without the slightest grasp of basic facts. We're now in the remarkable position that national newspapers in America publish lead stories about religion that contain glaring howlers of the type that any church-going Catholic could correct, because there's no one left in the building with any domain expertise. And you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone working for a major TV or news channel who knows, for instance, what a papal nuncio is. My favourite example of this in action was the New York Times reporter who asked Christian writer and editor Father Richard John Neuhaus of First Things what he made of the fact that the newly elected Pope was, quote, also, end quote, going to be named the Bishop of Rome. If it's not obvious to you why that's funny, the Pope is, by definition, the Bishop of Rome. That's his job. Christianity in general, and Catholicism in particular, is an impossibly complex subject for a general reporter to master in an afternoon. But because reporters, editors, and proprietors are mostly Democrat and mostly secularist, religion has been one of the first areas to go when newsroom cuts have been made over the past decade. Unless it's pandering to Islam to annoy Republicans, they just don't want to know about it. So we're left with specialist magazine writers, all of whom have their own particular biases and objectives. Perhaps the only reason this latest child abuse conflagration has captured the attention of English-speaking journalists is that they've identified a way to bash conservatives in the story by pointing out that Vigano's political leanings suggest he may be biased, and because any kind of sexual abuse story is grounds for an otiose pivot back to the Me Too movement and another 400 words about the evils of patriarchy. In matters of theology and the complex arena of church politics, journalists do what they do in any situation where the facts would be too exhausting or time-consuming to uncover, which is they go with the guy the conservatives hate. In this case, that means siding with McCarrick and Francis. As Ben Shapiro correctly points out, the media have rushed to Francis' defense because Francis is widely perceived to share leftist sensibilities regarding issues like climate change, illegal immigration, and homosexuality. The media believe that the abuse of children is of lower priority than climate change and illegal immigration. Furthermore, they fear that focus will be placed on a homosexual subculture within the church, some of whose participants have been linked with molestation, end quote. Tough stuff, but it's perfectly accurate. It's possible that journalists genuinely don't know what all the fuss is about. After all, so many of their own idols are pederasts. As the great firebrand Anthony Eastlin, writing for Crisis magazine, reminds us, San Francisco supervisor Harvey Milk, the first openly gay elected official in the US, groomed and seduced young boys. But he was turned by the left into a civil rights hero. Harry Hay, Allen Ginsberg, and William S. Burroughs are all taught in literature courses. All three were blatant and proud pederasts. Lolita, it's considered great literature. The old boys of the left covered endlessly for Sir John Gielgud. R. Kelly's exile seemed to last minutes. Roman Polanski was given the red carpet treatment on his way back into the tent by Meryl Streep, and that's before we even get to the decades of la 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 I'm not listening it took to keep Kevin Spacey's cocaine-fueled indiscretions with young men out of the press, or to hush up Guardians of the Galaxy director James Gunn's obsession with sexualized images of children and his creepy personal blog on which he bragged about beating up his midget girlfriend. But if the media doesn't really care about sex with minors, they gleefully assaulted this author when he dared to make a few jokes about his own experiences and speak frankly about a few facts of gay life. Couldn't be, could it? that in fact journalists care nothing at all for the victims of child sex abuse and instead use this emotive subject merely to destroy their political opponents. Couldn't be, could it, that pederasty's only bad when conservatives do it, and that it's so bad that merely joking about something that happened to you is enough to get you machine-gunned. But how else to explain the behaviour of the mainstream press this year? Everything journalists have done in reporting this crisis has been to protect the reputation of a pope perceived as a leftist and to save the feelings of the homosexual lobby, which hates it when gay people are talked about honestly in public as the promiscuous, low-income, drug-taking, reckless and often very unhappy people we statistically are. The cover-up in the Vatican is a gay crime, performed by gay men in service of other gay men, concerning assaults overwhelmingly performed by men on young boys, and a debased culture of gay orgies in what ought to be an educational establishment. In the Catholic world, gay scandals have a habit of multiplying, and that's not just because young male seminarians tessellate. It's not just a gay crime, it's also predominantly a left-wing gay crime, with the perpetrators more likely than not to be hippy-dippy, loosey-goosey innovators with the liturgy, heterodox on family matters, and very bad managers of diocesan resources, especially the schools, in the words of one journalist. In the long run, no amount of soft-peddling from the New York Times is going to obscure the fact that the corrupt, socialist, homosexual mafia in charge of the Holy See is a disease, which, if it's left untreated, is going to destroy the Catholic Church. Maybe that's the New York Times' plan, but the rest of us are not going to stand by and watch it happen. You can imagine the panic, can't you, at the New York Times when a new scandal erupts and it looks like all the bad guys are left-wing gays. You know, reporters go and Google them and all that comes up is speech after speech after speech about climate change and how best to embrace Islamic migrants. Well, they quickly take to their typewriters and whatever can be published to distract attention from the perpetrators is hastily cobbled together for the morning edition. Take this Times headline from August 2018, which appeared in print as "Francis takes high road as conservatives pounce, taking criticisms public." Online, the Times headlined the story, "Vatican power struggle bursts into open as conservatives pounce." And that phrase, conservatives pounce, has become something of a joke since. But here's how that story began. "Since the start of his papacy," says the New York Times, "Francis has infuriated Catholic traditionalists as he tries to nurture a more welcoming church and shift it away from culture war issues, whether abortion or homosexuality. Who am I to judge?" the Pope famously said when asked about gay priests. Just how angry his political and doctrinal enemies are became clear this weekend when a caustic letter published by the Vatican's former top diplomat in the United States blamed a homosexual current in the Vatican hierarchy for sexual abuse. In case that's too subtle for readers, embedded in the page before the main body of the story was a video of Francis with that "who am I to judge" malarkey about queers. So Times readers are left in no doubt who the bad guys are. Elsewhere, the same day, Reuters published a story with the headline, "Defenders rally around Pope, fear conservatives escalating war." Not much mention of the allegations against Pope Francis that he covered up the rape of children. The media's protection of Francis worked for a while, most notably in the early myth-building period of his papacy. As recently as November 2017, the Washington Post was still running headlines like, "How Pope Francis Can Cleanse the Far-Right Rot from the Catholic Church." That one aged well. Catholic news services have expressed surprise on the rare occasion a mainstream outlet has covered alleged wrongdoing by Francis without smothering the reporting in defensive language or vague gesturing toward a conservative conspiracy. Pope Francis enjoyed remarkably high approval ratings among Americans for some time, but down from a peak of two-thirds. In early 2017, only 48% of Americans have a favorable view of Pope Francis, as of this writing, because no amount of spin can obscure the facts. Among Catholics, the number is 63%, down from 83%. Among Republicans, Francis's approval sits at just 36% in one CNN poll. A second Gallup poll showed a similarly low approval rate among the general American population of just 53%. This is an enormously sharp downturn for a pope we were constantly being told was the most popular ever. The pope's approval rating is expected to drop even further, with women abandoning their previous fondness for Francis at the most rapid rate out of all demographic groups, which is perhaps the maternal instinct finally kicking in. First Things editor Rusty Reno suggests that the lingering cover-up culture in America might have been made possible because America's bishops began the 19th century unusually powerful and autonomous. Their authority wasn't limited by hundreds of years' worth of Catholic institutions, such as libraries, faculties, and cathedral chapters, and they were not subject to European canon law. American bishops have acted more independently of Rome than their European counterparts, and some journalists conclude that, combined with the bishop-centric church structure that obtained after Vatican II, abuses in America have gone unpunished thanks to cowardice and poor oversight from Rome. But it appears that the Vatican knew what was happening all along and simply did nothing about it. Some of the time, feigning ignorance. And that's a trend that's reached its apotheosis under Pope Francis. One last note about the delay. Thomas Sowell has observed that any given social problem typically becomes a focus of attention and government action only well after the problem is significantly improving, usually with the effect of retarding progress. Certainly this has been the case in the campus rape crisis of the last half decade, an outpouring of confected rage about perhaps the safest public spaces for women anywhere in the world, at a time when rape rates are in freefall. The church and the media follow this rule now when it comes to clerical sexual abuse, reluctantly opening investigations when the worst offences are already half a century old, and the statute of limitations has long since passed. This virtually guarantees that victims will see no justice and no compensation for their ordeals. And if all that hasn't depressed you enough about the moral ruins of the Catholic Church, consider another reason that Francis ferociously protected Theodore McCarrick, and how the most morally indefensible actions by the Vatican come to be made, and why it takes decades to bring some of these men to justice long after the victims can have their proper day in court. And that is money. McCarrick, you see, was one of the church's most effective fundraisers, establishing a papal foundation in 1988 whose assets have grown today to more than $206 million. That foundation built $70,000 schools in Bangladesh, $90,000 libraries in Nicaragua, and $100,000 orthopedic units in Ghana, so you can't say it's doing no good work. But each of those projects comes with a nice overseas junket, or at least it used to, for Theodore McCarrick. Everything was going swimmingly at that foundation until the summer of 2017, when Pope Francis personally requested an immediate grant from the foundation of $25 million. That's 100 times higher than the usual grant size, and it was for a church-owned building in Rome that is notoriously corrupt. Rod Dreyer, writing for the American Conservative, reported that the hospital has been accused of money laundering and has liabilities of more than $1 billion. This is not normal. Except perhaps in Italy. The Papal Foundation, which is maintained by wealthy Americans, does not invest in this kind of project, and it had been given no opportunity to perform due diligence on the hospital. But the bishops and cardinals on its board, led by none other than Cardinal Wall from Washington, forced through a wire transfer for half of the $25 million Francis was demanding just a few days after the request came in. What was the money for? Where did it go and to whom? We will probably never find out. When Francis was informed that the other half of that grant would not be forthcoming, he responded with spectacular pettiness. He cancelled the foundation's annual audience with him at the Vatican. And the plot thickens still more, and this is why I'm telling you of all this, when you discover that one board member, Tim Bush, is friends with the author of the letter that began this whole scandal in the first place, Archbishop Vigano. Could this be a case of telling the truth about sex as payback for arrogant senior clerics pushing around the laity and picking their pockets? That's a question Rod Dreyer has asked. For all its rapacious acquisition of wealth, the money the Vatican does manage to collect from naive donors is spent so haphazardly and accounted for so incompetently, or just as likely dishonestly, that it makes you wonder why they bother in the first place. But to understand, as a lay Catholic, just how badly the church spends your money, you first have to understand how thoroughly the organization was co-opted, decades ago, by communist activists. Yes, you heard that right. Despite popular myth, the church has never been a friend to European fascism. John Cornwell's malicious and error-strewn 1999 bestseller Hitler's Pope, which was of course warmly received by the media with a title like that, was a libel on the legacy of Pius XII, and it helped to solidify the myth of the Catholic Church as a sinister, Nazi-sympathizing right-wing club. In fact, we now know that Pius XII's actions in Italy and via diplomats throughout Eastern Europe could have saved as many as 850,000 Jewish lives. But don't hold your breath for Hollywood to make Pius's list anytime soon. It may be no friend to fascism, but the church has often been a willing vessel for communism, to the point of near convergence. To the surprise of some non-Catholics, the Church has always been, in fact, something of a left-leaning institution. We did, after all, invent the concept of social justice, and there's a long history of infiltration of the churches by communist sympathizers and by activists and spies. In many cases, this occurs with the cooperation of priests. Sometimes they're the same people. In the 1930s, communists in the West were told to rejoin churches and other Western institutions to begin weakening them from the inside. The Communist Party's infiltration into Catholic seminaries was designed to turn the church from a spiritual hierarchy to a more explicitly political organization, with the goal of weaponizing it, encouraging the religious poor across the world to rebel against what the communists called the institutionalized violence of poverty. In 1968, as the clerical abuse crisis reached its zenith, the KGB-created Christian Peace Conference persuaded leftist South American bishops to hold a conference in Colombia to explore Marxist liberation ideology. Capitalism is the most effective engine of social mobility the human species has yet devised. But communists not only sought to leverage the church against it in the name of alleviating poverty, they also aimed to enfeeble the most powerful institutions of liberal Western capitalist democracies, like universities and the press, and they did a pretty good job in those cases. There's no higher calling to a Leninist than weakening the system upon which Western civilization is based, and that's Christianity, especially Christianity in its most potent Roman form. The Catholic Church was therefore identified by communists as more important to the success of the West even than the means of production. Saul Alinsky, author of the activist handbook Rules for Radicals, identified two basic social forces which, he said, might serve as the cornerstone of any effective community organization in 1980s Chicago. They were, first, the Catholic Church, and second, organized labor. The pro-abortion and pro-birth control Alinsky had lifelong friendships and working relationships with many Catholic priests, especially in Chicago, some of whom raised large sums of money for a project that came to be known as the Catholic Campaign for Human Development. That Catholic on Catholic Campaign for Human Development was added later in typically Orwellian, Marxist, Kafkaesque fashion because the CHD was getting a reputation for funding causes that weren't very Catholic, and in fact that ran directly contrary to church teachings. And Alinsky proudly explains his bamboozlement of the Catholic hierarchy in Rules for Radicals. Alinsky's CCHD is still active today, still endorsed by the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, and still collects money from ordinary Catholics, which it funnels into pro-abortion and pro-contraception groups under the guise of anti-poverty and racial healing. This is thanks to a combination of complicity and naivety from church leaders. To this day, hundreds of ordained ministers support outright Marxist organizations in America, and there are deep ties between church officials and far-left political activist groups, such as the Democratic Socialists of America. The Syracuse Cooperative Federal Credit Union receives funding from the CCHD, despite supporting gay marriage and donating to Planned Parenthood. In her last book, conservative hero Phyllis Schlafly reprinted documents that showed Barack Obama receiving his community organizer training in 1986 at Alinsky's Industrial Areas Foundation, and that was courtesy of the Catholic Archdiocese of Chicago. The Catholic Church's close association with communists goes all the way to the top. In September 2018, Francis signed a deal with the Chinese government that codified Communist Party interference in the selection of Chinese bishops. The deal not only grants the Chinese power to nominate bishops, but it also requires the Vatican to recognize 7 excommunicated bishops currently operating without papal consent in China. This deal makes China the only country in the world in which the Pope's authority to select bishops is circumscribed by state authority, and China isn't even a Catholic country. Persecution of Catholics in China is at its highest level since the Cultural Revolution, according to human rights campaigners. A longtime missionary and China expert, Father Sergio Ticozzi, told journalists the same month that Francis signed that deal that the Chinese government seeks absolute control over the Catholic Church. This agreement brings them closer to it, and with legitimacy derived from the Holy See itself. Matthew Schmitz from First Things suggests that the deal even violates commitments made at Vatican II, that the Church should support neutral religious liberties rather than seek privileges from the state. In other words, Francis won't jeopardize his progressive activism to protect children from being raped, but he will suspend those principles along with centuries of church tradition to make deals with murderous totalitarian communists. Since at least as far back as Gregory VII, whose conflicts with Henry IV over the Church's authority were largely settled in Rome's favour, the Vatican has insisted on no state interference in church matters. Until now. As a communist dictatorship, China is officially atheist, and it tolerates some religions while viciously persecuting others. There are about 12 million Chinese Catholics, but their worship is severely restricted. The government regularly tears down crosses, burns Bibles, and puts believers in concentration camps where they are gently reminded, on pain of death, to be loyal to communism before they are loyal to God. As many as 90,000 people may be detained in these re-education centres. And in August 2018, a Catholic news agency said Chinese police had broken up two summer camps for children. These children were aged 8 to 10, accusing the organisers of holding an illegal Christian event. In March 2018, the government used a crane to rip the last cross from the roof of an iconic Catholic church in the Henan province. And this is the regime to which Francis has handed control of bishop selection. Francis didn't do it alone. The cardinal at the heart of this deal between the Chinese government and Pope Francis, who travelled regularly to Beijing on the Pope's behalf over the past two decades, until he was unfortunately indisposed recently, was also critical to the process. His name was Theodore McCarrick, and by 2005 McCarrick had been to China seven times on church business. According to Archbishop Vigano, one of Francis's first acts as Pope, just 3 months into his pontificate, had been to return McCarrick to active duty by dispatching him to the People's Republic. After re-ingratiating himself with the Chinese regime, and of course being billeted by the Chinese in seminaries, McCarrick dismissed warnings from Chinese bishops about state interference in worship. In February 2018, in an interview with Asia Times, Pope Francis made no mention of religious freedom in China, preferring instead to lavish praise on the Chinese government, telling the world not to fear the rise of China. Gregory VII is looking down on all this, and honestly, he's just thrilled. Chapter 4. Feminism is spiritual cancer. It might seem, with all this moral turpitude, as though we've returned to the Middle Ages, but as so often is the case with that expression, we do a grave service to the medieval period. It's actually much worse than that. The Church's original whistleblower on sexual abuse, Peter Damian, was a Middle Ages Italian cardinal, and he was horrified at the scale of sexual immorality throughout the Church. He wrote to Pope Leo IX in 1049 about rampant sexual harassment, concubinage, and bishops who failed to enforce church discipline. Damian wrote to duchesses, popes, and whoever else would listen, agitating for reform with some success. He was something like an 11th century Me Too organizer, just without the smugness and hypocrisy. It's sometimes claimed that Leo IX didn't listen to Damian, but this isn't true. It's an anti-Catholic smear that originated in early 20th century scholarship, much of which was seeking to overturn traditional church teaching on sodomy. It's a project that bishops have continued to this day. The lie, which has been widely read in works of revisionist history, like Derek Bailey's Homosexuality and the Western Christian Tradition, has endured, but it's endured without much evidence to support it. It's incontrovertible, for a start, that Leo IX did a lot more than Pope Francis. Priests who had violated their oaths by having anal sex or having sex with lots of different partners were barred from re-entering the priesthood. Diane Elliott of Northwestern University gave a lecture in 2015 in which she said that the medieval church's fear of scandal created a culture in which secret sin was preferable to public shame. She said, quote, "the very gravity of sexual sins seemed to argue for their suppression," end quote. And she claims that this amounted to, quote, "a tacit policy that took its toll on the most vulnerable members of Latin Christendom," end quote. Well, Diane Elliott was wrong about the Middle Ages, but if she'd been speaking about the present day, she'd be right. While Damian and Leo IX did try to do something about the problem, the modern church has buried its head in the sand, preferring, as Elliot puts it, secret sin to public shame. Damian was a strong advocate for celibacy, which is often cited by leftists as the reason for sex scandals. But if celibacy were the problem, you'd expect medieval clergy, who paid no attention whatsoever to injunctions about celibacy, to have had somewhat healthier sex lives, but the reverse was true. Problems in the 11th century church mirror our own, but they were far more widespread and the stuff going on was far more gruesome. Bishops were immune from secular law and could compel priests into acts of sodomy for their own grotesque amusement. Many bishops at the time kept live-in prostitutes, which, if it happens at all today, is restricted to a couple of monsignors in Rome. There was a technical requirement for celibacy, but it was so routinely ignored it may as well not have existed. Men were not only getting married, but they were at the same time practicing sodomy with underage boys and getting up to all kinds of other horrors. This suggests that the problem isn't celibacy. The problem is men. Give us an inch, so to speak, and we'll take a mile. And the only logical remedy, therefore, is stricter enforcement of clerical rules for those who choose the priesthood as a vocation. In the Middle Ages, rules about celibacy weren't enforced at all. Today, they're enforced weakly. What we need is celibacy rules in place that the priesthood is actually expected to adhere to. The reason the clergy should be celibate, of course, is that they serve God at the altar and not their own urges. It may sound extreme to modern ears, but Damien advocated for self-flagellation as one route to an intensification of the devotion to Christ, and if that doesn't sound like fun, it isn't meant to be. The priesthood should be a calling, not a free lifetime membership to a gay bathhouse with the occasional pit stop to deliver a tedious lecture about diversity. Seminaries have been admitting trainees to the priesthood who are fundamentally spiritually unserious, and they should stop it. It might be no bad thing for the priesthood to be thinned out a bit. After all, the problem is not a lack of priests today, it's a lack of churchgoers. And it's a lack of churchgoers produced by post-Vatican II vandalism. What brings people into the pews is serious devotion and the great drama of Christ's incarnation, crucifixion, and resurrection. A renewed seriousness about the faith would not only refill the pews, but would also require that the priesthood took its pledges more seriously. As Dennis Prager has pointed out, it was Judaism that first began the process of protecting and elevating women by putting the sexual genie in the marital bottle, ensuring that sex no longer dominated human interactions. This Judeo-Christian tradition made it honorable to be the passive partner as a woman, elevating and celebrating womanhood, as embodied by Mary, in a way that no other religious tradition ever has. Catholicism rejects the empty promises of the modern sexual revolution that has made men and women so desperately unhappy and utterly out of touch with one another. It forbids contraception as a violation of the law of God and nature while encouraging sexual pleasure between married couples. Thanks to science, we now know that birth control, as a handsome devil once put it, makes women unattractive and crazy. The same guy also explained in some detail, if you'll recall, in December 26, that the more we learn about our bodies and the universe, the more we realize that the Catholic Church, at least the Catholic Church prior to the current corruption, really was right about everything. An appreciation of the beauty and the equality of the sexes, which was brought about by the rise of Christianity, heightened male-female love and sexuality, and it made love and eroticism within marriage possible. Christian societies used the image of Mary to elevate women still higher, inventing consensual marriage and developing codes of chivalry, as we will see in a later chapter. It was Christian societies that gave women the power to say, I do, and perhaps more importantly, the power not to. But feminism reversed all this progress, telling women they were weak and in need of special protection from the horrors of men, and by characterizing the male active partner's role as degrading and disreputable. Andrea Dworkin said that women who have sex with men were collaborators, more base than other collaborators have ever been, experiencing pleasure in their own inferiority. With the same upbeat optimism and lightness of touch we're familiar with today from Clintonian Twitter crazies, Dworkin insisted that every woman's son is her potential betrayer and is also the inevitable rapist or exploiter of another woman. Over Dworkin's desk used to hang a poster that read, "Dead men don't rape." Dworkin, like Arianna Huffington, married a gay man, though, unlike Huffington, she did so on purpose. Contrast this messy, miserable dystopia with a passage from Alan Bloom's last book, Love and Friendship, in which he talks about women's souls after Christianity. Shakespeare, he says, seems to have thought that Christianity affected a deepening of women and a new sensitivity of men to them. The souls of women have become more interesting than they ever were, and Shakespeare is the poet of women at least as much as he is of men. And that's from a gay Jew who died of AIDS, not the sort of person you'd expect to speak fondly of the Catholic Church. But he's right. And the difference between the high pedestal upon which the Church places mothers and womanhood and the gutter the godless Dworkin sees herself occupying could not be more stark. God created Mary, the unspotted mirror who reflects his greatness, as a monument to his reverence for all women. As Father George Rutler puts it, feminists believe men and women are the same but unequal, while Christians know that men and women are equal, but they are not the same. The best book on the feminization of the church is Leon Podal's The Church Impotent, in which he explains in more detail than we can go into here just how the church degenerated into its present unhappy state. While Islam and Judaism have predominantly male memberships, Podal notes that something is creating a barrier between Western Christianity and men. He's scathing about the church's cringeworthy attempts to relate to young boys by comparing grace to jet aviation fuel. He leans heavily on one of the books that has made the most lasting impression on this author, David Gilmour's Manhood in the Making, which you should go and read and rejoin me here when you've devoured every line. It's much more important that you read that than you listen to this. It explains almost everything that has gone wrong between the sexes in Western civilization, and which has in turn permitted the horrors of the Me Too era and the farcical Brett Kavanaugh hearings. The most damning observation about the church that Podal makes is that it doesn't even seem to care that straight men are abandoning it. Catholic circles, he says, are full of committees and conferences on the place of women in the church, but almost none on the absence of men. And in this respect, the church is in sync with other left-wing institutions like the universities, in which women are flourishing and outpacing men, but at which only women's concerns are regarded as worth airtime and investment. The problem, he explains, is especially bad in black churches, which are filled with misandrist women and which have nothing to say to disaffected young black men tempted into criminality and spiritual impoverishment. All that these left-wing churches have to say about masculinity is that it is bad. It hurts women. Men are properly the objects of fear, ridicule and scorn. Wherever possible, male toxicity should be monitored, and boisterousness and overzealousness, critical components of healthy manhood, should be viciously punished. And what else should we really expect from an organization populated by tepid homosexuals and white-hot women? Gays flocked to the priesthood in the mid-20th century at the same time that some straight men were abandoning it. In the 1970s, hundreds of men per year left the clergy to get married, and the rise of feminism as industrial strength man-repellent probably played some part in their initial decision-making. Don't underestimate how far men will run to get away from batty feminist broads, especially when they get wind of how elegant and lovely are women of faith. For these men, the call of marriage and family, the cornerstone of the Catholic faith, eventually became too strong to resist, and it must have been tempting in the mid-80s, during a feminist wave driven by obnoxious termagants, to escape to the seminary. It was a male-only safe space, after all, from which young men could simply check out of this cultural moment. But eventually they did find their way back to marriage. Dworkin's 1986 novel, by the way, Ice and Fire, captures the spirit, or at least the feminist aspect, of the spirit of the age, depicting every male character as cruel and repugnant. They're basically all rapists, except one gentle soul who's pleasant because he's impotent. When that unfortunate condition of impotence is reversed toward the end of the novel, he too becomes a violent monster. The implication being that any properly functioning man is a menace. Ice and Fire explains at agonizing length how sexual relations are, by their nature, a monstrous invasion of women, a theory that is an abhorrent inversion of God's intent. The narrator of her novel repeats the phrase, coitus is punishment, drawn from Kafka, throughout the book. And this was a theme that Dworkin expanded on in the nonfiction Intercourse. Apropos of nothing, by the way, Allen Ginsberg was an early mentor of Dworkin's until she got annoyed by his relentless pursuit of underage boys. As gays and feminized men, both the products of single motherhood, have colonized the clergy, churchgoers have themselves, statistically, become more female. This is likely in part a product of modern dysfunctional families, but at least within the confines of the church, it sort of suits both of them. It also might explain the leftward lurch of so many Catholic dioceses in the Western world, gay priests and heavily female congregations. And I do mean heavily. You should see some of the church's most recent female recruits complain when they're told they only get one wafer each. The idea of a sanctimonious social justice warrior in a chasuble banging on about diversity and global warming sounds ghastly to most of us. But to the disproportionately left-wing wives and mothers in the pews, perhaps it's just what the doctor ordered. Unfortunately, it just doesn't appeal to anybody else. Liberalizing churches in this way has the well-documented effect of emptying them of worshippers, which is one reason that mass attendance has fallen flat under Francis, and that's despite this pope's supposed runaway popularity. In large part, it is men who continue to flee. Just as you don't solve cratering church attendance by adding more of the thing that's driving it, you can't save the church itself by throwing out the thing people come for. The rule book. Mainstream critics of Catholicism want it to modernize, by which they mean become more like us. More like NBC, we ask them, which sent orders down from the very highest levels to stop Ronan Farrow's reporting on Harvey Weinstein. More like the Academy, with its kangaroo courts and moral panics. Or do they want us to be more like New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, who directed the State Attorney General to halt its investigation into Harvey Weinstein just 6 days after receiving a massive campaign contribution from Harvey's former law firm? Those examples, by the way, are drawn from a column by David French in National Review, which makes the observation that sexual libertinism has not created sexual utopia. Instead, it's created, as it always creates, and I'm quoting from him here, a ravenous culture of sexual entitlement, exploitation, and abuse. Why do I feel the need to make this obvious point? Asks French. Because there are apparently still people who believe that the path through Christian sex scandals, such as the abuse scandal that's rocking the Catholic Church, is the transformation and liberalizing of traditional Christian teaching about sex. French ends by saying, quote, the path to scandal is indulgence, the path through scandal is repentance, and the path to renewal is obedience. Distraught Christians shouldn't look to the world for inspiration. The world has nothing to offer but the very misery we presently endure. End quote. It's easy to point to the transitory sinful pleasures of the world, but much harder to make the argument for virtue. But calling people to worship is calling them to joy, to sing before the throne of the Lord in praise of his great work of creation. Living in sin is living in misery and shame, as the America of 2018, drenched in sexual permissiveness and racial animus, knows all too well. It shouldn't be as hard a sell as the Catholic priests are making it, which suggests that an alarming number of these Catholic priests simply aren't themselves especially conversant with the joy of being made in the likeness and image of our Creator. They're too busy violating little children. They've forgotten that their calling, while demanding, is a calling to joy. Too often Catholic priests are not taking their service at the altar seriously, perhaps because their first experience was of a church taking itself unseriously, by not enforcing its own rules about homosexuality and celibacy in the clergy. Despite everything we know about the deep dysfunction embedded in the curia, it's still the world that's the most broken, and not the church. The American institutions most completely sacrificed to the cultural left are the most broken of all. These are the most godless places, the most miserable places, the places racked with ruin and chaos, colleges that are no longer capable of executing their core function of education. A media crippled by Trump hatred and uncomprehending of half the country that it presumes to report on, and an entertainment business imploding under the weight of harassment claims from hypocritical women who entered into deals with producers and then turned around 20 years later and claimed assault. And that's before we get to Hollywood's final reckoning, still on the horizon, when the drink and drug-soaked exploitation of vulnerable young gay men and the systematic rape of children, both as endemic to Beverly Hills as child abuse has become to the Catholic Church, finally come to light. Beneath changing demographics in the clergy lies a more fundamental shift in the way the Catholic Church has operated and presented itself over the past 100 years. Conservatives sometimes refer to it as the feminization or homosexualization of the church through progressive waves of left-wing entryism and aesthetic vandalism, aimed at the sort of sexual liberation David French correctly warns will undo the church from the bottom up if it's allowed to continue. Channeling the excessive energy of boyhood into a responsible masculinity is an essential rite of passage, without which a young man is doomed to a life of poor impulse control, dependence, and failure. The church has completely removed itself from this critical moment in a boy's development because it has become a place unappealing to masculinity, hostile to heterosexual men, especially if they're conservative, and especially if they are themselves in the clergy. Sometimes the assaults on church traditions have come from within, such as the liberalizing Ecumenical Council Vatican II, which relaxed many of the rules on, for instance, the use of Latin in church services. After Vatican II, priests were encouraged to face the congregation during Mass to make it more accessible, and they were discouraged from wearing vestments that were too elaborate. The shocking state of contemporary Catholic music is a product of the democratizing effects of Vatican II, and something conservatives speak about today with justifiable sadness and horror. Progressive reformers don't restrict their entreaties, by the way, to agreements actually made at the Second Vatican Council, but they refer instead to the spirit of Vatican II as a sort of carte blanche justification for ever more liberal approaches to liturgy and worship. And if that sounds familiar to you, it should, because it's exactly what living constitutionalists in the United States do when they don't like one of the rules. One factor in the abuse crisis might be priests reared in the strict Jansenist atmosphere of the early 20th century who were then abruptly shoved into an unduly permissive post-Vatican II world. It was the worst of all combinations, like delivering free beer and condoms to the teenagers in a strict Muslim household and then telling them mum and dad will be away for a few decades. Because liturgical changes as profound as Vatican II would have affected everyone in the church, we shouldn't discount the possibility that the young men of the priesthood at the time simply weren't ready for that much sexual freedom. It's worth remembering that prior to Vatican II, at the start of the 20th century, the priesthood was held in extraordinarily high regard. In other words, when the rules on the clergy's behaviour were strict, people liked them more. Vatican II absolved Jews, past and present, for the death of Christ, and it gave fresh weight and authority to the College of Bishops, but it also introduced indifference to some of the most precious customs and beliefs of the Church. It's a mystery why so many young Catholics adored Benedict XVI's traditional, old-fashioned approach. But vanishingly few priests could tell you why. What passes for spiritual nourishment these days in too many Catholic parishes is the equivalent of empty calories from a candy bar. Sort of momentarily titillating on the lips, but not a bit satisfying or nutritious, serving only to enlarge the appetite for more empty things and to make the nibbler fat. Crummy music, hideous vestments, and lectures about feminism. I'm not kidding. No wonder women love this new version of the church, because it consists of too much coasting on a surfeit of sugary emotional self-indulgence. I can imagine some people feeling great listening to one of those hippy-dippy sermons about recycling, or how it'd be better if we all just shared more with each other, or how mean men are and how we should all just be so much nicer to black people. Everything from Catholic priests these days is that kind of like, oh, so nice, touchy-feely stuff. Catholic priests especially touchy-feely if moms aren't watching their little kids carefully, but nowhere to be found in all this are the strict spiritual admonitions that the faithful, adrift in a disorientating and globalized world of hyper-consumerism, so obviously and desperately crave. As Archbishop Chaput expresses it, the big atheist murder ideologies are dead, but they've been replaced by the far more effective practical atheism of a system based on consumer wants and needs. American advertising and entertainment are the most powerful catechists in history, also the most pervasive. I think he's right. The church needs to wrest back that mantle of most pervasive and powerful catechist. Rod Dreyer's experience decades ago of a church that asks nothing of its followers and merely congratulates them for being who they already are is not unusual, and it's been getting worse. It's one of the reasons people are losing faith in the church. Nowhere to be found any longer are the masculine virtues of strength, courage, forbearance, endurance. Grit and gumption have become dirty words. As Robert Louis Stevenson put it, our religions and our moralities have been trimmed to flatter us, till they are all emasculate and sentimentalized and only please and weaken. Truth is of tougher strain. In the harsh face of life, faith can read a bracing gospel. Gone from the modern Catholic Church of Cormac Murphy O'Connor and Pope Francis is anything resembling such manly fortitude. Willa Cather, most famous for her novels of the rugged frontier, never married, but she nonetheless appreciated the ineradicable need for manliness, and she wrote, quote, "It makes one exceedingly weary to hear people object to football because it is brutal. Of course it's brutal. So is Homer brutal, and Tolstoy. That is, they all alike appeal to the crude, savage instincts of men. We have not outgrown all our old animal instincts yet. Heaven grant we never shall. The moment that, as a nation, we lose brute force, or an admiration for brute force, from that moment, poetry and art are forever dead among us. and we will have nothing but grammar and mathematics left. The only way poetry can ever reach one is through one's brute instincts. A good football game is an epic. It rouses the oldest part of us, the part that fought ages back down in the Troad with manslaying Hector and swift-footed Achilles. Gone too, from today's church, is the fire of righteous anger that believers feel when they see injustice in the world, but for which their church provides no useful outlet. With its gay clergy and its estrogen-filled pews, it is not a stretch to say that the Catholic Church has become a pretty unwelcome place for men generally, and even among the gays.